This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Allegations of sexual misconduct against author Sherman Alexie are falling into a now predictable Me Too script. So we're going to hear from two native writers who say that blacklists and Twitter takedowns miss a chance at actual community healing. That's coming up this hour. Also, is your dog allowed to take up a seat on a Metro bus? So I hope you'll stay tuned for the whole hour. We are going to begin, though, with the boss of Seattle. Jenny Durkin has been mayor for 104 days now, and you have questions for her about taxes and crime and parking, and we'll get to all that. Mayor Jenny Durkin, welcome back to the studio.
Hey, thanks for having me here. And all you people out there on the pledge drive, give, give, give. This is a great station.
Thank you for that. Now, you went from not having ever been a politician to running the city of Seattle. What has been the biggest surprise for you so far?
I think the biggest surprise for me is how warm people are every part of the city. I mean, I knew that. But, you know,
they're not just complaining at you?
No. And when I came in, everyone said, oh, look, the only thing you're going to hear about is what things are wrong. And people give you your mind and they tell you what they're thinking about. But everywhere I go, people have ideas on how to make the city better. And even the people that are struggling the hardest want to make it a better city. And I knew that kind of intellectually, but now I see it and feel it in my bones.
Well, that's a very constructive attitude. Now, in your State of the City address, you gave us a warning.
Our significant economic growth has allowed us to increase our spending in recent years. But these boom times won't last forever. Unfortunately, a deficit is on the horizon.
On the horizon. When will the city run a deficit?
You know, we are looking right now. I'm talking to my budget people, and I'm going to be asking every one of our departments to submit a budget that is between 5 to 10% less than they got last year, depending on what the nature of it is. We're going to take the fewer cuts from the public safety agencies. But part of the problem is that we put in place new programs with one-time money. And so we've created these, you know, instead of having a dedicated revenue source for all the programs that we're doing, we have short-term revenue sources. So we have to be planning for the future in a very responsible way and make sure that we can live within our means.
Are you frustrated with Mayor Murray for leaving you bills?
No, I think that we had a city that was on the rise and people and were trying to address real problems. But what I hear from more and more people is they're feeling tapped out. Our property taxes are high, our sales taxes are high, our B&O taxes are very high, and people want to give, but they feel like that they want to see progress and results from government.
Yes. In fact, speaking of property taxes, a listener named Aaron has emailed you this question. My home property tax has doubled since 2015. The massive tax raises every year are pushing people like me out who saved and budget for a home, only to see their monthly payments go higher and higher every year, possibly pushing us out of the city. What are the plans to stop the painful tax burden on property owners and help keep people in their homes?
We have to do a series of things. I'm very happy that the legislature in Olympia this past session passed a law that allows us to give some relief to seniors, veterans, and a few other people so that we can go back and see the city share of the property tax. Can we give those people some break? It is hardest on the people who are on fixed incomes. Some people living in their homes have lived there forever, and now their property taxes exceed what their original mortgage is.
Can you somehow means test property taxes? Because you could look at property taxes as progressive on people who aren't on a fixed income. I mean, they're sitting on a pretty valuable home in some cases.
That's why we're trying to look at those categories of people that the law allows us to help, like seniors and veterans. But we know everybody is, it's hard for everybody, and the property tax is going up. I'm glad that the legislature gave some relief, so the City of Seattle and others that are funding most of the McCleary decision will see a reduction of what we thought that amount was. But we know we have some really important levies that are up for renewal. The Families and Education Levy this year, the school levies next year, the 911 levies, and those are all property tax base. So we have to be very careful when we scope those levies to make sure that the people who are asking to pay for these services can actually afford to stay in the city.
The city council might pass a head tax. That's a tax that Seattle's highest grossing businesses would pay based on their number of employees. Would you sign that?
We have to see what comes out of there. You know, they have a hearing tomorrow. The report was just released yesterday. I pledged to the small businesses in Seattle when I formed my advisory committee that I wanted their voice on every important decision that we're making. So I'm going to look to them to see how they think it impacts small businesses. We have to be really careful not to have a bad impact on our small businesses, because not only are they struggling right now, but the burden, they are employing the very people we're trying to protect.
But this head tax is on the highest grossing businesses.
It's so on, that right now, what's now is proposed is every business in Seattle would pay some amount.
Oh.
And so we have to see, they haven't decided exactly how they're going to stratify it, who pays just a flat fee, whether it's an hours tax, whether it's a head tax, and how much it would be. I think that in all taxes, what's really important is, do we need the money and how are we going to spend it? And so I'd be very anxious to see first, what data are they basing it on? And what's the plan? Because I've now, in my 90 days, have some idea that we need to do how we're addressing the homeless issues differently. For example, Seattle can't go it alone. It's a regional issue, and we need to have a regional plan.
Speaking of homelessness, we have a question from Courtney, a KUOW listener, who asks, what are you planning to do with all the tents on public property?
You know, right now we are, our biggest problem in clearing tents from public property and getting people a safer place to live is that we don't have more places to move people. So we want to have more capacity in our short-term shelters that are safe, warm, and dry. It's one reason why one of my first acts was to pass an ordinance that gave us $5 million to create tiny homes, microhomes, and alternative housing. So we're going to try to get that type of capacity in the pipeline as quickly as possible. We also awarded over $100 million in housing dollars. So we want to build as many places as possible. So we need more places to move people. But if we do, I've said it before, I believe that it's not right to have people living in very inhumane conditions on the sides of roads. We need to move people to safer places. And then we need more money for behavioral health, addiction services, and mental health treatment.
So to circle back on a couple of listener questions, Erin, who says she's suffering under the property taxes, you can't tell her specifically help is on the way, but you said there's some tools. In other words, do you think at the end of your first term we'll still be talking about people saying I'm being priced out of my home, I can't afford my rising property tax?
Yeah, I think help is on the way depending on who Erin is. You know, we know that the state had a one-time several hundred million dollar fund that will reduce what they thought the rise in property taxes will be. So they won't go up as much as we thought they would under McCleary. If you're a senior, a veteran, or a few other categories, there may be a chance that we can give some property tax relief to those people. And the other thing we'll have to do is as we are looking at renewing our levies, whether it's the family and education levy or the school levy or the 911 levy, we have to have an honest conversation with the people that are paying those property taxes so they know exactly what they're getting for their money.
Okay. And regarding Courtney's question, the tents on public property, again, by the end of your first term, like give us some kind of timeline, do you expect people to say, oh, okay, the city's getting, they're adding shelters, whatever it takes, the city's getting a handle on this. I don't see so much visible homelessness on the streets.
Absolutely want to make that kind of progress by the end of my first term. You know, homelessness, unfortunately, has been in the making for decades in the region. Our unbelievable growth exacerbated all conditions on the ground. And so we have housed more people than ever before, but more people are becoming homeless than ever before, which is one reason why One Table, which is the regional effort to look at this issue, is so important. We're actually looking at the root causes of homelessness, things like the foster care system, people coming out of jails, those things that we know are adding to the homelessness problem so that we can get to people and help them before they lose their housing stability.
Is the complaint accurate that Seattle's generous, quote-unquote generous policies attract more homeless people?
I would say that the data right now shows that Seattle probably does bear a larger burden of people who become homelessness throughout the county. And Mark Putnam, who was with King County, mentioned that in his exit interview. because so many of the services are located in Seattle, Seattle is paying the lion's share for people who come from other parts of the county as well. It's not 50%, it's not 60%, but it could be as high as 20%, maybe a little higher. So if you think right now our direct expenditures on homelessness are somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 million a year, indirect brings it up even higher.
But even outside King County, there's this image I hear sometimes that people know Seattle from far and wide, and they come here.
You know, we know there's some cities who put people on buses to Seattle, but for the most part, people who are experiencing homelessness don't have that kind of mobility.
Okay, speaking of mobility, and it's homelessness is not just a matter of visible homeless people camping in tents. A King County judge ruled that Seattle violated a homeless man's constitutional rights by charging excessive impound fees on a truck that he was using as his home. Why is the city appealing that ruling?
I think the judge, her inclination was right in how do we make sure that we aren't further burdening people who are poor with fees they can never pay. That's the right inclination. How the judge got there was wrong. The city of Seattle has to be able to control its streets, its rights of way, in order to serve the whole city. We're appealing it because if you take that ruling to its logical conclusion, we wouldn't just be talking about parked RVs and homeless tents. We'd be talking about parking in any neighborhood, blocking streets. The city has for public safety reasons, has an absolute obligation to control the use of its rights of way and make sure it's used for the greatest public benefit. And so I think the judge, while she had the right inclination to try to help someone who was poor and had these huge fees, the way they got there was the wrong way.
Will the city add more parking, free parking in city areas or in businesses where people like that man can go and park a car and
stay? We're going to work with neighborhoods and communities on addressing the issues of RVs and vehicles. It's not a uniform solution for any one area. Cars are mobile. And one thing that we have to be able to have a strategy around are those people who actually drive their cars here from other parts of the region and park in the city of Seattle because it's closer to services. It has a really detrimental impact on a lot of the neighborhoods and communities. So we have to find some solution for those people to be able to be housed more safely. We'll have a variety of strategies depending on where it is.
Talking to Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin and a question from Tony on Facebook. Tony says the streets on Capitol Hill have been in disrepair since Paul Schell was mayor. That was a long time ago for newcomers. Stop using all the money for needless bike infrastructure that only benefits an able-bodied few. Why won't you repair Seattle streets? End quote.
You know, we are repairing streets as quickly as we can. I can't remember the exact number, but I think since I've become mayor just in the 90-plus days, it's thousands of potholes, for example. And we have crews out every day. But we are really a city that is under construction. Every neighborhood, if you go to Pioneer Square, for example, the people there are struggling because they have the water main project, which is going to be followed by the streetcar project. We're working with our agency directors to say, okay, we've got to take a little bit of a pause here and make sure we're more coordinated than we've been. Because people have to know, can they get into their business? Can they get to their house? Can they drive down the streets? And so the voters gave us more revenues to improve our streets. And one of my goals as mayor is by the end of this year to have a plan in place to speed that process up because we have not been spending that money as anticipated, which means we haven't seen the improvements we need.
Streets were blocked to traffic downtown earlier this month when people protested a youth detention center, some of them lying down on the street. Seattle police did not arrest anyone. The King County Sheriff says that that happened on her beat. She would have ordered arrests. What are you telling Seattle police to do about demonstrators and why?
The Seattle Police Department has a very difficult job. They have hundreds of protests a year, some of them planned, some of them unplanned. Their number one goal is to make sure that they ensure public safety. And so they will always balance their actions of promoting public safety, protecting the First Amendment against what is the convenience for the rest of the public in an area. In this instance, they made the judgment that it was better at that point in time to not disrupt these protesters. I know people have said that traffic was terrible and it was all because of these protests. I think that everyone's always looking for a reason why traffic is terrible.
Uh-huh.
I said it, I think, when I was here before I was mayor, and I will say it again. Traffic in Seattle is terrible. It is going to get worse, and it's not the mayor's fault.
And what about the police chief? You think the police did the right thing in this case by not arresting and hauling off demonstrators off the street?
I think you don't want a mayor that micromanages every police action in the city of Seattle.
Okay, but even in retrospect, now you have the chance to just say, I would have done it differently, or you could say, good job. What would you say?
I would say that I don't think anybody knows enough about all of the surrounding factors to make that judgment. I will get after action reports on actions like this to look and see, is there things we could have done better and different? I will say that, you know, one of the things that the commander who was in charge determined was he was not going to let rush hour be blocked.
Right.
And told the demonstrators there will be arrest by 3 p.m.
Yep.
And they dispersed. And so, you know, we'll use that to determine should we act similarly, differently. What people should know, though, is that does not mean that people have a free check to block streets. That's not going to happen.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, ending our time here pretty soon. A couple more questions. Some students plan to walk out of class tomorrow in support of gun regulations in the city. Are you encouraging students to walk out?
I support the students in walking out and will be joining the students to walk out and hopefully be at Red Square with them. I think that we are at a moment in time when our country is facing an issue that we have faced and not dealt with for almost a generation.
Is that a blanket encouragement for a walk out of school if there's a policy you don't like?
No, I think that, you know, right now young people have found a cause and they may be the solution. And we have to deal with guns. We have too many people killed with guns in this country every single day, both by force, violence, and suicide. And if we don't address guns as a society, I think we are missing a big opportunity. I think that youth know that they have to have a solution. They believe in their own safety. They believe that they can make a difference. And I support them in trying to make that difference.
Finally, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. Thousands of hockey fans jumped at the chance to buy season tickets for a team we don't even have yet. Did you sign up? Did you buy tickets?
I absolutely did. I wish I had a lower number. I bargained with people for it.
I bet you could.
Yeah, but I'm going to be at Storm games. I'm going to be at the hockey games when they get here. And someday I'm going to be sitting there watching the Seattle Sonics again.
And here's how you can have everything you want. If we get a hockey team, you could declare right now on KUOW the hockey team will be named the Seattle Supersonics. What do you say?
Oh, no, can't do that. Can't do that.
Okay, kill two birds with one puck or something?
Oh.
Not happening. Okay, Jenny Durkin is the mayor of Seattle. She's the boss. You're her boss if you live in Seattle. Thank you for your questions, and thank you for coming again, Mayor Durkin. Will you come back and we'll do this
again? I absolutely will. I apologize. It's taken me so long to get here. Love being here.
We'll do it soon. Thank you.
All right, thanks so much.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in a moment. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Over the past few weeks, we've been talking about the allegations of sexual harassment against Native author and filmmaker Sherman Alexie. But what's getting lost in that conversation? I'm here with The Record's producer, Ajua Jimabrempong. Hi, Ajua.
Hey, Bill.
What are we about to hear?
So we invited two women, Tracy Rector and Sarah Marie Ortiz, into KUOW. You know, I was chatting with them, and they said that online, on Twitter, it's these kind of takedowns and cutting people out of anthologies and scholarships, kind of the standard Me Too script.
Mm-hmm.
But within the Native world, I think people are really see an opportunity for real community healing.
Community healing. We're going to listen now to filmmaker and arts advocate Tracy Rector. She's a member of the Choctaw Nation and executive director, co-founder of Longhouse Media, and Sarah Marie Ortiz. She's an Acoma Pueblo writer, filmmaker, and advocate. And they said that in the Native world, this discussion is not new.
We've been having this conversation for a long time. Not specific to any one person, not one particular community member or relative, but the fact that there are lots of things in the Native community, and particularly the Native art world, the film world, the lit world, where we know that we've been built into and impelled in many ways by a system that wants our stories but doesn't necessarily want to honor our lives, and that sometimes it does end up being distilled as a black versus white, man versus woman kind of dichotomy, that it's not as nuanced as it can be, and that a lot of that is because our literatures, our narratives, our rights and lives, our struggles around sovereignty and land protection, they haven't been centered in the American narrative, in the American imagination, and that is something that needs to change.
So that makes me think about this idea of putting a, you know, people on a pedestal, and how one of the issues with Sherman that I noticed, especially on social media, was that people were grappling with his prominence and the spotlight solely on him, and noticing that it was an infrastructure of the broader literary community that oftentimes tends to be white, and putting him up on that pedestal for various reasons. What are your thoughts about this, and how do we empower more writers and more voices to be noticed?
Well, I have lots of thoughts, more thoughts than we have all the time for here. So I'm grappling with that. But I should say as a preface, I love Sherman. I love him to death, and I love his family. I love his body of work, and I think that he's worked extremely hard, and that in a lot of ways he is doing an incredible service in this moment to all of us. And that's something that's not a popular statement, but that we needed him to rise, and we kind of need him to fall. We have him on the autopsy table now, and it's not just about Sherman. It really is about our community, our world of arts and letters.
Mm-hmm. We're in a time where I think that it's very real and very essential to our survival to think about what does balance mean. I noticed in the arts that much of what comes to the forefront of pop culture and what people remember or identify with has been masculine in nature, whether it be Black Panther or, in this regard, Sherman Alexie. He's had a voice that's resonated with many people because, in my opinion, our general broad society and culture doesn't tend to honor the feelings and voices of our young men and boys. And so I think that was something unique about Sherman's stories and his body of work, is that he was coming forward oftentimes with some incredibly personal stories and stories that were bound in pain and fear. And people wanted this and needed this. And so I feel that his artwork brought balance in that regard. Men need to have a platform for expression. Men need to be recognized for being willing to share their innermost thoughts. But the way that, in my opinion, the way that he was propped up and put on the pedestals in this essentially kind of a black and white dominant way, where there is just one person, there is this champion, there is a winner, and that person gets to be on a pedestal. And I don't know if that's a systemic issue or a cultural issue, but it does feel out of balance to me. So he presented and presents this interesting dynamic, in my opinion, where in many ways his voice brings and brought balance, but then the positioning of him as the winner, the champion of all Native writers, the voice, has brought a certain imbalance. And with what's happening, I agree with you, Sarah. You know, we needed him to shine, and in many ways, we need the shakeup as a community. There are so many incredible authors and writers and poets and scriptwriters who are Native women, and they truly deserve to be seen and heard. And unfortunately, there was not oftentimes a clear path for those voices to be uplifted and supported. And now we're starting to see them come forward. And so, yeah, so I agree with you. I am grateful, even though this is devastating to grapple with these challenges, I'm grateful that there is a way that perhaps this can be constructive for our people and our communities moving forward.
Well, I'll say that we still need Sherman to shine. The fact that he has been kind of excluded excoriated or stricken from the map of Native literature that a lot of librarians and those who provide resources to the Native community, they're just like, Sherman needs to go away for a while or forever, kind of like Harvey Weinstein. But to me, that's totally anti-Native. That's counter to our teachings. And for me, I still need him to be healthy. I need him as metaphor and as just a man, one Native man who is a relative, who is our beloved community member. I need his heart to heal. I need him in my community. I want him in my community. And I want to have a very honest conversation with him. And many people do. They don't just want a comment from him. They don't just want a soundbite. They want to cry with him. They want to hold him and say, what the f*** happened, Sherman? And what's going to happen? And are you going to be okay? Are we going to be okay? And I'm saying to all the Native youth out there, all the Native men out there who have done a harm all along the spectrum of what that may mean, we need you. We need your hearts. We need you with us. We need you alive, and we need you strong, and we need you healthy. So you're not going to be cast out, and we are going to be strong, and we are going to hold you.
It's hard. You know, where is the space for us to be humans and to make mistakes? And that's something that's come up for me in this situation, is acknowledging his past, acknowledging his sovereignty as an adult man to make choices. But he's human, and he's a product of colonization and trauma and a community in pain, both the joys and the hurts that are birthed from those experiences. I don't know. I don't want to be under a microscope. I don't want to pretend that I'm perfect or that I have never made a mistake or that I will never make a mistake again. I want to be able to move forward in life and try my best and to ask for help when I need it. And I hope that we can extend this sort of consideration or compassion to more of those people around us. I think what's truly detrimental is holding secrets. And when we're able to acknowledge that we are complicated, messy human beings who are bound to grow through trial and error, that we can begin to heal.
I would echo that for sure. And one of the things that has hurt the most about this and has hurt the most from the time that I started writing as a 14-year-old Pueblo mother in the making. That's when I first started writing a personal narrative. I thought, even at that young age, really deeply about some of the harm, some of the scary things that were in my community of Albuquerque, New Mexico, so many Pueblo and Diné people, but the Native women, the women of color around me, a lot of them Chicana and Black, and feeling like all of us were kind of under siege in a lot of ways, that we weren't safe in that city or possibly anywhere. We literally feel like we're in a police state and that we're constantly being harmed and harmed again. It's just not easy to think about in isolation, one man or one woman, one figure that is the bad one, represents the patriarchy. It's our systems.
I think that's part of the opportunity of having this dialogue and not this situation or this issue or this moment being something that happens this week or for 2 weeks and is forgotten. I want us to continue to talk about this and work through this and understand what solutions we can collectively think about in moving forward. Again, I feel very strongly about that takedown or casting away of people who've truly committed some of the most heinous acts. I think that there's an important place for that. But I do not think that we need to reenact a patriarchal colonizer way of approaching justice or injustices. I want us as a community to figure out best practices and understand what is most supportive to the healing of our communities. And I'm grateful that you were okay talking together today, because I admire your work and your words and what you're doing for the community. So it's really good to have this time with you.
Well, likewise, more than I can say. I have so many words, but I hold you in the highest esteem, Tracy, so you should know that.
That was filmmakers and arts advocates Tracy Rector and Sarah Marie Ortiz wanting to improve on the hashtag MeToo script in the wake of sexual harassment allegations against author Sherman Alexie. And they're talking about seeking a better model of community healing here on The Record on KUOW Seattle. It's The Record on KUOW. So it's pouring rain. You've had a long day. Your bus is late. Finally, it pulls up. You get on and it's packed, of course. You look around and you see, oh, there's a seat open. Wait a minute. What? It's not open. Something's in that seat. That something is not human. What do you do? Well, here to tell you the rules is Seattle Times reporter Paige Cornwell. Hi, Paige.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Good story in the Seattle Times. Will you tell us your bus story?
Sure. Well, I was on a 8 bus one night and...
A number 8 bus. Where's that?
That goes through, let's see, it's the Mount Baker bound bus. So it's through Capitol Hill and South Lake Union, right through Amazon Land.
Uh-huh.
So I had taken it a little further.
Amazon Land might figure into this.
Yes, it does. So I was riding the bus and it wasn't too full. And this woman got on with this cute dog. It was a Yorkshire Terrier wearing a sweater. I thought, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, so cute. And she put it down on a seat. And I thought, oh, that's kind of weird. You can put this dog in your purse. Like, why does it need its own seat?
Mm-hmm.
I assumed she was going to keep, or she would move it once more people got on the bus. And as we got closer to what I call the epicenter of Amazonia, right by that Whole Foods at Westlake and Denny.
Yeah.
A ton more people got on. It was a completely full bus, and she didn't move the dog. The dog was just sitting there. There were people in the aisle glaring at her and at the dog, but no one did anything.
Yes, you called this the confluence of Seattle's love of dogs and Seattle's fear of conflict.
Exactly. And I guess I'm part of the problem. I should have said something, but I thought it was so hilarious that I just wanted to see what would happen.
Well, how do we know that the people standing minded? I mean, you said they're glaring, but if someone had asked, she might have put the terrier on her lap.
Probably. I don't see how someone could say, no, my terrier deserves its own seat.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't pay the fare for it. But I could hear people behind me saying, oh my gosh, why isn't she moving this dog? And people were looking angry.
Looking angry and just hoping she took the cue.
Right.
Some people, I don't think in Seattle, but some people would just have moved the thing aside physically, you know, just sat down. I'm pushing this non-human aside and sitting on my seat.
Right. I probably would have said, oh, that's so cute. I'll hold the dog and sit down.
Oh, that's a much nicer way of doing it.
Yes.
And you have seen a growing number of dogs on your routes.
I have, yes. I typically take buses around Amazon and other tech offices that are more dog friendly. And I have noticed more dogs on buses. And it seems more passengers who are just fine with letting their dogs sit in the aisle or block other people's way.
Yeah. And personally, I don't mind standing in a bus. I don't think I would have minded the dog sitting on the bus, but some people, they feel differently.
Right. If you had a long day.
Yeah, if you had a long day. And Amazon is one of those companies that's allowing more people to bring their dogs to work.
Yes, they have thousands of dogs that are registered. You have to register your dog to bring it there, and thousands of dogs go there every day.
What are Metro's rules, official rules, about what dogs can ride?
So it was so funny. I asked around, and it seemed like no one really knew the exact rules about dogs on buses. So I asked King County Metro, and they were kind enough to not just say, wasting my time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can bring a dog on a bus. If it's a small dog and that you can just put in your lap, that's fine. Just keep it in your lap. Mm-hmm. If it's a bigger dog, you have to pay a fare. But I've never seen that before, but you are expected to pay a fare.
And you can buy an Orca card for your dog.
You can, yes. Or you can just tap yours twice, but you have to let the driver know you want to do it twice.
Right. You'd say, I'm two.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So dogs are allowed. Can a dog take up a seat? Is that allowed?
It can. If it's a registered service dog and there are seats available, it's fine for the dog to sit on the seat. Or if there's a person who needs their dog maybe sitting there for a medical reason, that's fine. But if it gets too full, you're expected to move your dog.
And are drivers enforcing that rule? If apparently passengers are just glaring, are drivers ever saying, that's against the rules, move the dog?
I've never seen that. A few bus drivers actually sent me emails about this after the story ran. One said that for the most part, it's fine. The only issue is if a non-service dog who isn't as well-behaved bites another service dog. Hmm. But they, for the most part, say, we're so busy, we just, you know, we don't do anything.
They're not asking, is that a service dog?
Some drivers will do that, but a person can say yes. They might be lying, but they can't require documentation. So you could just say, yes, it's my service dog, and walk on.
I bet that's a lot of people who just say
probably.
Yes.
Yes. One driver said that a woman actually was honest and said no, and he said, well, you need to pay a fare, and she was really surprised by that and acted all put upon by it.
Yeah, and drivers and passengers in a hurry don't necessarily want to deal with drivers having to deal with a put-upon passenger.
Right, exactly.
Just keep it moving.
Right.
These people who fake their service dogs, I wonder if they also complain about illegally parked RVs and camping on public land.
Maybe. I also think
the rules just don't apply to some people.
Right. And I also think that some people might assume that like a therapy dog or an emotional support animal is a service dog, and they're two different
things. Those are two different things. Yes. Yeah, will you explain that?
A service dog is one that has gone through training and has a very specific purpose for how it's helping its owner with usually a medical condition.
Right.
An emotional support dog is one that some places recognize it, like airlines sometimes, and just if you have anxiety, the dog is there, but it's not performing a specific role.
And on Metro, it has to be a service dog, not an emotional support animal, as
right.
far as Metro is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to dog owners if it's not being enforced, and you can understand why it's not always enforced. Dog owners have to use the space responsibly. What are some irresponsible ways that they use the space?
One bus driver said that he saw a dog peeing in the aisle once, and then the owner didn't do anything, just walked off, which is gross.
Not cool.
Sometimes you see people in the very front of the bus, which is the disabled seating, and they'll be sitting there and the dog's taking up space there. And not only does that block the entry, but it also might be taking away space for someone who really needs it.
And I might assume that I might be more likely to assume it is a service dog if it's in the disabled area. I'm
right.
even less likely to say something.
Exactly, right.
Service dogs, couldn't they have to wear big tags with their license number clearly printed?
They could, but you can also buy a service dog badge or coat online on Amazon.
Yeah, but if we had official looking tags with a number on it, I could be on my phone if I'm really that kind of person. I could look up there. Oh, yeah, they really are a service dog.
Maybe.
Could look it up. And by the way, Paige, we're talking with Seattle Times reporter Paige Cornwell, who wrote this whole story, got a lot of attention. You're not a dog hater, as some people think you are.
I am not a dog hater at all. I am ridiculously into dogs. I have my own dog. She's a French bulldog named Penguin. She is the light of my life. I love dogs.
Do you really mind a dog being on a seat? Some people, I'm reading your comment section, and some people are grossed out by the whole thing. That's a dog's butt that's been there, all that kind of,
right.
It really, what's the big deal? A dog, a person? It's just my pants are going to sit on there. I'm not licking the bottom of the seat. Who cares?
Right. I have no problem with it, but I know maybe for some people they might have allergies. They may have had a bad experience with a dog.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know their background, and so you have to respect that too.
Right, right. And is this the same situation on light rail as it is on Metro buses?
No, on light rail you have to have the dog in a carrier. On Sound Transit buses as well.
Yeah.
You can bring a small dog, but it needs to be in a carrier.
No dogs that are out of carrier that's not in a carrier are allowed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is Metro even considering that?
I haven't heard any issues with that, especially when you have so many employees who take buses to work every day and they bring their dog with them.
So what's your conclusion, Paige? What'd you learn from all of this?
I learned that
we can learn now.
Yes.
Thanks to you.
Seattle cares very much about transit and dogs. That's
mm-hmm.
what I learned.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think at some point either Metro or bus drivers are going to have to make the decision, because right now there's a lot of sort of ways that people can find loopholes into bringing their dogs on the bus.
We may have an unsustainable tension on our bus system right now with the canines.
Yeah.
Paige Cornwell, Seattle Times, wrote about this. Thanks for doing it. And thanks for coming in, Paige.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. The show is made for you by Amin Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimma Brempong, and Jason Pagano, and social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke.